100% born in the Appalachian Mountains and made in the USA, Timber Ninja Outdoors provides a range of mobile hunting options to accommodate diverse hunting preferences. Whether you prioritize comfort, lightweight design, or versatility, their two-panel and single-panel saddles collection has something for everyone. The Black Belt Nano is the lightest single-panel saddle available on the market, weighing in under a pound. The saddle is designed with the minimalist hunter in mind, focusing on lightweight functionality and breathability. One notable feature is the patent-pending magnetic stick clip system on the side, which allows for convenient transportation of sticks up the tree, as well as a built-in platform holder. The Nano saddle can be folded up to the size of a Nalgene bottle, enabling easy portability. With a four-way stretch material on the back for a comfortable fit, as well as strategically placed padding for hip pinch relief, you can use code EASTMEETSWEST to get free shipping on any Timber Ninja order. If you try it out and don't like it, send it back within 30 days for a full refund. Learn more at TimberNinjaOutdoors.com and sign up for their email newsletter for exclusive discounts and product drops. When it comes to optics, I get the same question over and over again. What are the best all-around binoculars? Well, it's tough to find something that works in every condition great, but after using a pair of Maven B1.2 10x42s, I think I found them. They feature an 8x or a 10x option, superior low light performance, tack sharp edge-to-edge clarity, a generous depth of field, and a silky focus mechanism. All of Maven Optics have a lifetime no-fault warranty and hail from the great state of Wyoming. I've been using Maven Optics since I bought my first pair in 2017, and I think you should test them out for yourself. Head over to mavenbelt.com and use the code EASTMEETSWEST-GIFT for a free gift with any full-price optics order. For all of those that want a truck bed cover for work or play, Diamondback makes the top-of-the-line, heavy-duty covers that help you do more with your truck. They're perfect for the truck-owning, avid sportsmen, outdoor enthusiasts, and weekend project warriors. I'm currently using the HD cover that is capable of holding up to 1,600 pounds on the top. And then I have the Yakima Overhaul HD bars on top so I can put my rooftop tent on it. When I'm not using my rooftop tent and able to use the trifold design of the Diamondback, I have the Crossbin 8 in there to organize all of my stuff in the back of my truck bed. Diamondback is made right here in Phillipsburg, Pennsylvania. If you want to check them out, head over to diamondbackcovers.com. If you've wanted that hunting camp tradition that we talk about, that experience, but you don't have a hunting camp of your own, you're welcome to come stay at my hunting camp up here in the Pennsylvania Wilds called the Elk Crossing Getaway in the PA Wilds. So if you go over to Airbnb, you can check out our three-bedroom, one-and-a-half-bath house that's right in the heart of Pennsylvania elk country. It's only minutes away from a bunch of public land to be able to hunt, hiking trails, outdoor recreation, fishing, all of those things there. The house is completely fully stocked with everything that you need to be able to spend a week hunting deer, taking your family up to see the elk, anything like that. So if you head over to Airbnb and search Elk Crossing Getaway in the PA Wilds, you'll find my listing there and you can rent out my house. Send us a message, an inquiry that you're interested in it and mention that you heard it on the podcast here, then we'll get you 10% off of your first stay.
Are you an adventurer looking to take your hunt to the next level? Then you're in the right place. Welcome to East Meets West Hunt with your host, Bo Martonic.
Hey everyone, welcome back to another episode of the East Meets West Hunt podcast presented by Spartan Forge. On today's episode, I'm joined by Rusty Johnson of United Outdoors. Rusty is from the Ozark Mountains of Arkansas and has a dedicated year-round approach to chasing mountain bucks. We discuss the importance of ditches, vegetation gaps, hunting all winds, taking mountain tactics to Kansas, trail cameras, deer stories from the past, and much more. It looks like I'm on a southern tour here with these guys. I've been finding a bunch of really cool hunters and big woods mountain hunters down in the southern states that are absolutely crushing it. And thankful to some of my buddies at the Southern Outdoorsmen who were willing to introduce me to some of these guys. And actually, Jacob was offering it to me. He's like, man, I want to hear how you interview these guys with your tactics and how they and how they cross over. So it's pretty cool. So I've been able to talk to some of these guys, and it's just wild to see the similarities in the South and some of these mountain ranges that we have up in Pennsylvania, New York, Ohio, West Virginia, and everywhere in between. So, but yeah, I'm excited for you guys to get to listen to this episode. But before we get into it, let's do the Mountain Buck Monday story of the week. And this story comes from Matt Theriault out of Ohio. So Matt wrote in, "I shot this mountain buck during the Ohio muzzleloader season. I made my way up to a ridge top and snuck up to a tree that would keep me from being seen by any deer that could be on the other side. While taking my backpack off, I spotted this buck bedded down on a bench below me about 150 yards to my right, but no shot. I stalked to 105 yards from him and was able to get a shot on him, and he tipped over right in his bed." And so this story from Matt, he had sent it in a little while ago here, and you need to head over to East Meets West Hunt on Instagram or East Meets West Outdoors on Facebook and check out this deer. This is an absolute giant Ohio mountain buck, just mass for days, tines, character. I mean, this thing has it all. And the fact that he shot it in its bed, that is pretty dang cool. So congratulations, Matt. And if you have a story that you want to send it in via email to bo@eastmeetswesthunt.com. Just a short paragraph or two and some photos, and love to be able to share these stories. And for anybody that has sent them in the past or different social media platforms and stuff, there's so many places to receive messages. It's really difficult to keep up with. So I know when emails come in, I can categorize them, throw them in my mountain buck folder, and are able to make sure I don't miss anything. So looking forward to getting to share some more stories there. And the only news that I have this week, so I should be just getting back from Utah when this goes live, but this Sunday, July 30th, my Montana archery elk hunt film called Riding Mountain Waves is going live. So this film was from 2022 season when I spent 21 days in the mountains of Montana archery hunting elk. And I really wanted to do this film differently than any of the other films that we've done in the past. And when I was talking to Justin Mueller, who does all the video work and editing and does an incredible job at putting together these films, and I was like, you know, I don't want a 15-minute film. We can't do that with 21 days. I want for everyone to be there through the whole roller coaster of the hunt that it was, but I didn't want to have an hour and something long, just one piece film. So what I did was kind of like I do with some of these podcasts is I split them up into two. So there's two like 30 to 35 minute films. One's going to come out this Sunday. Part two will come out the following Sunday. And it's really a cool one. Make sure you have the volume up on your TV, because it is a very vocal hunt with a lot of animal sounds, and just, I don't know. I'm really excited about this film to get out there and for everyone to get to see it and get to see the fun and the struggles and everything that comes along with public land archery elk hunting. So yeah, I'm excited for that to go live. It should be about, I think I have it scheduled for 7 p.m. But subscribe to the YouTube channel, subscribe to the email newsletter on the website. You'll be notified when that comes out. And I would really appreciate it if you like it, share it with your friends or leave a comment, whatever it is. All that stuff helps out a ton. But anyways, we will talk to you next week. I hope that everyone has a great rest of your week. All right, we're live. Rusty Johnson, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, Bo. Good to be with you. Glad you're having me on.
Yeah, I'm glad to get to talk to you. I was introduced to you finally formally through a mutual friend, Jacob, at the Southern Outdoorsman. Jacob and I were on the phone, and we were just talking back and forth about people. He's like, "Know who I really want you to interview?" He's like, "Rusty Johnson." He's like, "I think you're style of hunting and the way you hunt in the Appalachian Mountains, I think you guys would have a really good conversation. And I was like, yeah. And this has happened to another guest here recently, but it was like, funny you say that. I've had his name written down for a while and just kind of needed, you know, the push for the introduction to go through with it. So I always like to talk to someone ahead of time and get to know them a little bit. And I've been following along with you for a little while on social media and YouTube and everything. But I'm really, really excited to get to talk to you.
Yeah, I'm excited to be on here to talk to deer hunting.
Heck yeah, buddy. It might be hot out. It might be the summertime, but it's deer hunting's on my mind. I actually just got back from scouting trip here a couple days where I just went out and just put a bunch of cameras out. I was actually telling you that on the phone the other day. Yeah, I was going to be doing that, and it was hot as balls out, that's for sure. But got the cameras out, so that worked. What have you been up to?
Oh, I've been doing the same thing. I've been putting some cameras out. I've done one card pull, and it's looking pretty good from the first card pull. So they're really starting to get out there, start forming those frames. And it's a growing season, man.
Yes, it is. I know. And I've been mostly just putting cameras out and haven't been checking them as much. I have two cell cameras out now, so I've been able to see a little bit of that. But typically I don't run the cell cameras until a little bit later, try to keep down on the data plans, you know? And lithium. Are you running lithium batteries in yours?
I do in the cell cams. Regular cameras, I don't. I just run Energizers or Rayovac.
Gotcha. I started moving to a little bit more of back to the alkaline batteries in some of my regular cameras too, because it's just, man, lithiums are through the roof.
Expensive. Oh yeah. Yeah. It's expensive.
Yeah. If anybody has any deals they find on some Energizer lithiums, please let me know, because I hate paying almost $3 a battery. It seems like.
I know it. Yeah. I'm constantly looking for deals on those.
Yeah,
They're hard to find though, man.
You know what? If maybe it's a good business idea, just selling batteries to trail cam users, like having a hub and trying to find the right places to be able to sell it. But so I'm giving that idea to anybody that wants to take it on and go out and do it and make our lives easier.
Oh yeah, good idea.
But anyways, before we get too far, Rusty, how about you give a little bit of a background on who you are, kind of where you're from, and you know, kind of how you like to hunt?
Okay. Well, I'm 51 years old. I'm quite a bit older than you, so I'm an old guy. Still hanging in there, though. But I grew up in southwest Arkansas until 1998. And then we moved to northwest Arkansas with the family. Been here ever since. As everybody knows, this is the Ozark Mountain region. And so I've got 25 years or so of experience hunting the Ozarks. So I've got a little bit different hunting style than most, but I have been successful, as you can see in the background. I'll probably tell you a story or two, but I've really enjoyed hunting these mountains up here. It can be very challenging, but it can be very rewarding when you do connect with a really nice buck. So that's kind of the short of it. I'm pretty much strictly a bow hunter. Probably in the last 20 years, I've killed one buck with a muzzleloader. The rest have all been archery. So I'm pretty much just strictly a bow hunter.
Okay, nice. And what's interesting to me is the Ozarks are pretty unique as far as, you know, like the Appalachian Mountain region is, you know, there's obviously a lot of terrain here and a lot of terrain there, but the Ozarks have a different feel to it, at least from what I looked at from map scouting, is there's just like a lot of different fingers and ridges, and they all go in different directions. It's a lot less of these longer ridges and a lot going on.
Yeah, there is a lot going on. I mean, you have your traditional ridges and stuff, but there's a lot of ditches, secondary ditches, and a lot of stuff to really choose from to try to connect with one of these bucks. But it's a real diverse terrain.
Yeah, no, it's pretty cool looking. What about, like, what's the vegetation like in that type of the region?
You primarily have white oaks, red oaks, hickory, dogwoods, maple, those type of trees. Vegetation, we have like huckleberries, honeysuckle, just in some native grasses here and there when the sun can reach the ground in these mountains. But
yeah,
there are some, you know, some of the Forest Service do some logging and stuff like that, and you can take advantage of stuff like that. You know, when the canopy's gone, then you have the new growth coming up, so you can take advantage of some of that.
Okay, so there is logging. That was going to be there my is, yeah. other question. Okay.
Yeah.
Does that, do you find, do you pay attention to that much as far as like the areas you like to look for with the logging cuts?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. So, yeah, when they cut like that, almost immediately, I feel like deer are attracted to it. You know, you got the new sprouts, you know, new growth and stuff like that. And we also do a lot of, or the Forest Service does a lot of controlled burning up here too.
Okay.
That's an interesting part of the equation too.
Yeah, that is interesting, because they don't do a whole lot of that, at least in the places that I hunt, as far as the burning goes. But logging, mm-hmm. definitely. What's the logging like? Do they do a lot of like select cuts, or just like full clear cuts?
Yeah, well, they do a little bit of both. It's mostly select cuts, mm-hmm. and they also do a lot of TSI too. So, it's not a lot of clear cutting up here where I'm from in Southwest Arkansas. That's just about all they did, but they also replanted it in pine trees. But up here, it's mostly select cut.
Okay. Yeah. That's, it's funny. I had one of my good buddies is a forester, which is awesome to have as a deer hunter, as a friend. But, he was telling me like Pennsylvania used to be primarily conifer trees in the past, and then a lot of the cutting and stuff that they did, and when they clear cutted it back in the 1930s and 40s, that really changed it and, you know, made it a lot more hardwoods, and you still have a lot of those conifers in the bottoms and some of the other areas, mm-hmm. but really changed it up. But you're right, as far as those newer cuts, like even the tops, like they're, I've noticed, like especially in areas where, you know, the deer density is not very high where I'm at, but in some places the deer's numbers are a little bit higher, so they'll leave a lot of the tops down to almost like try to make it difficult for the deer to walk in there and get
right.
it. But it
right.
creates a lot of browse for them on the outside too. Absolutely. Like right when those tops come down.
We also have a good amount of shortleaf pine trees too that's scattered around, and most of the time they're like in patches. So that creates a real nice edge a lot of times on the interior that deer like to travel.
Yeah.
But yeah, it makes it really, it's mostly deciduous, but we also have pine trees too.
Okay. Gotcha. And so to start this off, what's your favorite time of year to hunt? Like when do you spend the most time in the woods or have the most success?
I would say probably the last week of October and the first week of November. That last week of October is probably my favorite.
And as you're in that region, is it kind of traditional rut times as far as the rut is, you know, first couple weeks of November?
Yeah, it's that last week of October is more of like a pre-rut, what I call a pre-rut. They're kind of in the, I guess you would call cruising. Or they're not really seeking yet. They're just cruising around, you know, checking scrapes and stuff like that. They're not really in a chasing mode yet. But when you get into the first week of November and into the second week is when you really start seeing the chasing going on.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So that's very similar. It's interesting when I talk to deer hunters from different regions of the country, sometimes that rut shifts a little bit and changes. And with Arkansas being somewhat south, I wasn't sure if that was pushed back a little bit or if that's just some of the real deep south states that have weird ruts.
It'll fluctuate a few days year to year, but I mean, most of the time that real chasing is going on starting the second week of November.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. No, that makes sense. So you're liking, you really like that kind of pre-rut, you know, seeking phase of that time frame. And why is that?
I just think that, the deer are not quite in a rush. You know, they're starting to get it on their mind a little bit. And I feel like they're daylighting more. I think that's when they really start wanting to daylight more. But, you know, pressure has a lot to do with that too. But I like them when they're by themselves like that. I don't know why. I just feel like I can pinpoint them and pin them down a little bit easier that way before they start running wild, you know, all over the place.
And too, like with the, once they get locked down with does, you don't know when, when you're going to see them again. You may be in the woods and not have a chance for a few days while they're kind of laying down there with those does. And, and you know, it's funny because, and my opinion too, it sounds like similar to yours, like the pre-rut and the end of the rut time frame is your best odds of shooting a mature buck in the big woods of the mountains. I mean, because it's so hard with not having, you know, traditional primary food sources like fields or food plots or anything to be able to go to, and food kind of being scattered all over, bedding being kind of scattered all over. It's really difficult in that early time, but still, it doesn't make it easy whatsoever once it comes to the pre-rut and rut as much as we'd like it to be.
Yeah, hunting these mountains, is there's nothing easy about it. it's hard.
Yeah.
But you just have to be persistent.
Yeah, and that, it's funny because it seems like there's – I'll get the influx in messages as, like, the rut starts kicking off and people are taking their vacation. They're going 2, 3, 4, 5 days of, you know, not seeing a deer or not seeing many deer. It's like, you know, what are you doing? It's like, got to – keep going.
That's right. I love hunting the rut too. I mean, it's fun, but yeah, that last week of October is my favorite time to be out there.
What, so during that time frame, before we kind of roll into a little bit, I want to talk to you about some stories that are involved with it, but I do want to start off with some kind of groundwork as far as like what, based off my research of you and listening to you talk and stuff before, you're very big on terrain and terrain features. And it sounded like you had learned a lot of that from your father and kind of explained that to you. So explain to the audience a little bit about terrain and kind of what that means to you.
Well, so in these mountains that I hunt, there's a lot of, you have really, dramatic, what I call dramatic terrain features where you have like a major drainage and then you have major draws that go up to ridges and stuff like that. What I'm keying in on is secondary ditches is what I call them, secondary. And it may not be, but like a, you know, 10 or 15 foot dip, you know, that leads up there. It seems like to me that the more mature deer, especially, they like to use those terrain features when they're crossing a ridge. So it's just a minimal change in the terrain. It's not nothing major, not nothing drastic. It's just a minimal drop in elevation. It's hard to explain. I call them ditches, but it's not, somebody might think of a ditch as being like this, but it might be more of like a U shape, and it might be just faint. It might be just faint, and nobody, you know, somebody might walk right past it and not even really notice it's there. You have to really be looking. But the deer know they're there, and it gets them down in a little bit of a dip, and they like to travel those things, crossing these ridges.
Yeah, and you know, I'm glad you said that, because when I first listened to you talk about that, I was picturing some of these, and I'm sure it can be at some point, but really steep, you know, almost like straight cliff drop as far as these ditches that come up that you can find in some of this steep stuff, and then kind of where it levels off a little bit at the top. But I think that's a really good point, because even people in places that aren't, or that aren't hunting, you know, ridiculously steep terrain, these ditches are available.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, if you could just picture a really steep ditch, and you're walking along the edge of it, and there's just like a little break in the side of it where there's just a little slight, like a roadside ditch going up the side of it. Those are the type of areas that I'm looking for. I do hunt some steep ground, but those little subtle changes like that right there, I know it's hard to picture, but
yeah,
it's hard to describe, but it's just little subtle changes that I'm looking for.
Yeah, no, I think you're describing it pretty well, because like they're, And it's obviously it's a lot easier to identify when you're looking at very steep terrain because it shows up really easily on the map. You can see it. You can turn on your slope angle shading, and you can like really, you know, fine tune those areas. But even in like relatively flat, some of the big woods that I hunt doesn't have, you know, might only have a couple hundred feet elevation change in between different areas, and you can find some of those little tiny dips that are in there too, and for the bucks like to travel.
It's not much of a change, and you're not going to see it on a map. It's going to take boots on the ground to find some of these places. And I feel like after years of hunting in the Ozarks like that and realizing some of these little travel routes and stuff, that it's also helped me in the Midwest out there. Just a little bit of a change, it doesn't take much. It's just like a magnet for those deer. And they use it.
Yeah, because you hunt Kansas a lot too, and which is like completely different as far as looking at the terrain goes for where you're hunting the Ozarks.
Yeah, it's a lot different, but I use kind of the same philosophy on the terrain change. You know, there's where we go is in northeast Kansas, and it's kind of a rolling hills, but there's also a lot of flat ground, and just any little change, like a little drainage or, you know, anything like that, makes a huge difference in these travel routes.
Yeah, no, that definitely makes sense. I mean, even thinking about it, like you can take the same philosophies, like when deer are bedding, you know, when deer, you think about it typically in the mountains, you know, the deer like to have a good visual and some cover. Sometimes it might be a little knob that they're on. You can take that to a flat swamp, and it's like they're going to find that higher ground where they can see and have the cover available and everything there. So
it's good that you mentioned that, because in these little these changes in the feature, it also, the vegetation changes with it. And sometimes there might be different kinds of trees in that also. I mean, everything changes, not just the elevation, but maybe some vegetation or whatever, you know, is growing in there that is not normally on the other part.
Do you think, does that come from, you know, moisture, as far as like maybe that being a little bit of a catch basin for, you know, not saying it's like a swamp, but, you know, just having a little bit more moisture?
Yeah, maybe so. Now that you mentioned that, yeah, for sure.
Yeah, no, I was just curious about, you know, about how that, why that is, because I, you know, we see it too. And again, I'm halfway across the country from you, but we see the similar types of thing in those areas. And I've actually found, like, even in those places, bucks will bed in some of those spots. I'm thinking of an example in my head right now of one of those ditch areas that has some blowdowns in it. And it's like, in September and early October, I can bet that I'm going to jump a buck in there if I go walking through it. And it's just,
it just, blowdowns are huge.
Yeah.
Not only does it create a good spot for them to bed, it also creates a, like a gap, or it might close off a big area and they go around it. You know what I'm talking about? They might go around. It forces them to cross at a certain spot. Yeah, I key in on blowdowns quite a bit.
Yeah,
I find a lot of sheds in blowdowns too. Yeah.
Do you find them as far as like where they were, like the sheds in their beds, like they're laying there in those blowdowns?
Yeah, they like to bed in those for wind breaks and stuff like that. It's just cover. And I find a lot of sheds in blowdowns, or even like big logs that's laying there. They like to lay by those. So.
Yeah. Oh, that makes sense. And honestly, like I think you brought up a really good point when we were talking about, you know, kind of these, you know, funnels and things that are moving deer. When you're looking at such vast landscape like you have, like where you're hunting and where I'm hunting and where a lot of listeners are hunting, any little thing that can pin down deer movement, you got to pay attention to it. Like the blowdown thing, I was just setting up cameras, I was telling you just a couple days ago, and when I was in there, there was a spot and I was trying to figure out, I'm trying to target this one specific buck, and I'm pretty sure there's a part of his time he's laying in this one corner of this old clear cut that kind of comes out. And so I was surrounding this thing with cameras, and I was looking at it and I'm trying to think, okay, he's beat me for the last like 4 years. What is he doing differently? Like, I need to look at some more subtle changes. And there was this one spot that I was like, all right, there's couple blowdowns that are coming through here in this like little faint trail that came off it. There was a main trail that was like 40 or 50 yards away and this little faint trail and a couple rubs that I could see up in there that were there. I'm like, all right. So I threw a camera up and had picked out a tree as far as like as a potential spot to be able to hunt, because there's so many different ways in and out of this spot. Yeah. That I'm just trying to find those little details that yep. work out.
Yep.
Have you ever wanted to have Levi Morgan, Andy May, Johnny Stewart, and others available at all times? Well, you can with Cyber Scout from Spartan Forge. Cyber Scout is like the ChatGPT for outdoors men and women. You can ask it any questions related to bow building, scouting, hunting, survival, and a whole lot more. I think you'll be impressed with how it responds. Cyber Scout is currently out now for a select group of early beta testers and will be available to the rest of you really soon. The entire app is a complete tool for planning your hunt with incredible aerial imagery mapping, journaling, deer prediction, and some of the most accurate and detailed weather data. Use the code EASTMEETSWEST to save 20%. And if you're still on the fence, give the 14-day free trial a chance at SpartanForge.ai. CVA has been America's number one selling muzzleloader brand for over a decade. Hunting with a muzzleloader opens up a ton of hunting opportunities across the U.S., and I've been using the Acura series. But they don't only make badass muzzleloaders. Their line of centerfire rifles are great quality and not terrible on the wallet. The Cascade Short Barrel is ideal for tight quarters, deer drives, and quick shots in the big woods. You can check out their line of muzzleloaders, rifles, and accessories for every season and every range at bpioutdoors.com/CVA. If you use the code EASTMEETSWEST10, you'll get 10% off of all CVA products, which includes rifles, muzzleloaders, and accessories. Yeah. And also kind of going back to the ditches thing there, like what, okay. You're saying like the bucks like to travel through there, but what is attracting you to, or like, how are you like setting up in relation to that ditch? Because I think that's also a really difficult one to be able to answer. And maybe it's very situational, but
it is, it's very situational and there's no really right answer to that question. But if I think that they're traveling through there, I'll just plain and simple, I'll just sit within shooting distance of that little ditch.
Yeah.
I mean, it's, I don't know how else to explain it. I know that they'll want to travel through there and they're attracted to that. And I just get to where I can get a shot to that little ditch.
Do you find that you have trouble at all with the wind in those ditches as far as swirling going on?
Yeah, their wind is always trouble. And so, I mean, some people might think I'm crazy, but I hunt. So deer use wind to their advantage, right? So if you're using wind to your advantage, then you're totally opposite of what they're wanting to use. So to me, I roll the dice. If I see a tree or a spot that I think that I can kill that buck, I don't even care about the wind. I'll roll the dice and I'll get in there and try to kill him. And it's worked for me quite a bit. It has busted me several times. I ain't gonna lie about it. I mean, you will get busted, but in these mountains, I mean, if you're trying to hunt wind and thermals, I mean, you don't need to be reckless about it. You need to use common sense. But if I think that buck is going to be there, I will get in there and I will hunt that deer. I don't care what the wind is. I don't care what the thermals are.
Yeah,
that's just no. Bottom line. I just roll the dice a lot.
Yeah. I mean, I love that you said it that way, because, and I kind of knew that's the way you were going to answer it based off a conversation that we had. And that's kind of like what I've learned from my dad too, is like, he's the same way. And he's like, sometimes he's like, you got to be there and you get mm-hmm. busted. But it's, you know, to your point, it's like a lot of times you're not laying right on top of these deer, you know, where you're sitting at right. your stand, you know, they're traveling through there. So there's also a good chance that the gusts change up and it works out. And then sometimes it doesn't. And
you may, yeah.
And if you play that, I was just gonna say, if you play that. So the way I guess the way I look at it is I try to do everything in my and my possibility to predict what I think the wind's going to do and try to pick the best tree I can for that situation and then just hunt and go for it. Because otherwise, me and you were joking about it before, but otherwise, every time the wind shifted, I had to climb down from the tree, I'd never be in a tree because I'd always be moving. And you can't do that.
Especially in these mountains. I mean, the wind may change, 30 times within a day in these mountains. It may swirl. It may kick out of the north, may kick out of the south. I mean, you just never know. So the way I approach it is, if I've got this buck found, I'm going to go in there and hunt him. I'm a firm believer in spending time in the woods. And, if the wind's wrong when he comes by, it's wrong. If it's right, you got him. So that's my philosophy, is I just go and hunt.
Yeah.
No, I try to be where I think he's going to be in the daylight, regardless of the wind.
What is there any parameters with like wind speed or anything that you consider as far as like worrying about hunting those places? Or are you still just kind of throwing it to the wind per se?
Yeah, I'm just pretty much throwing it to the wind. Wind speed doesn't really matter to me. And another point to remember in these mountains, there's not a per se bedding area where the wind's blowing into a bedding area. These deer bed all over the place in these mountains. I mean, they'll bed on a point. They'll bed on the side of a ridge. I mean, they're going to bed where the wind is in their advantage. But, I mean, there's not like a bedding area. There are some, but most of the time hunting these mountains, there's not a designated bedding area. They bed all over the place. And I've watched them over and over and over. They may be walking, and they just may bed down right there. It's not a bedding area, but they bed there. So, yeah. You hear the saying, you need to get between food and the bedding. The mountains are just a little bit different. I know they are here. They may be different somewhere else, but here you just got to go and put the time in the stand.
What about with these, the location of the ditches, is there anything else like bigger picture when you're looking at a map that you want to have combinations of other things to say, this is a good ditch versus this ditch over here?
I do. That's a good point. So some of these ditches that I'm looking for, I'm looking for, like vegetation, what the vegetation is. And deer love going through gaps. It may be, just for example, if you got a fence going across a farm and there's a gap in it, they're going to go through that gap. They'd rather walk through a gap than jump that fence. Or if there's a gap, like if it's a barbed wire fence, if there's two or three cut wires, they'll go through that hole rather than jump it or anything like that. The same philosophy transfers over to like hunting the Ozark Mountains. There's no fences, but if I find one of these little subtle ditches that just say that's got honeysuckles in it, and there's a gap 20 or 30 yards wide and it's thick honeysuckles on both sides, where do you think they're going to walk? They're going to go walk right through that gap. And I set up to where I've got a close shot to that gap. I mean, it's just like a natural funnel for them.
So are you going through and do you map this stuff out as far as e-scouting ahead of time and like mark all these places and then just go check them out and then kind of grade them based off of that?
Yeah, I use Onyx a lot. I mean, I use it on a daily basis. I'm constantly studying the map, looking for new areas. And what I'll do is I'll mark these places out and I'll make a plan to go check these, put boots on the ground and go check them out and see what it actually looks like. If it looks good on the map, I'll just put a mark and then I'll go. If it doesn't turn out good, most of the time, if it looks halfway decent, I'll put cameras up and just see what I can get on camera. And if I locate one, then that's when I start my planning and the more detailed, going back and scouting more and putting a game plan together.
Yeah, no, I think that's a really good point too, as far as like the testing the spots out as far as like with the cameras is, as far as, a lot of times I'll go in and find these areas and walk them and be like, this looks good, but I really don't have any confirmation. I'll throw a camera up there. I may not even go back that entire season and just, check it later and be like, okay, this panned out kind of how I thought. Maybe I should spend more time here.
So So there's 2 months out of the year that I mainly do this. And when I say I do it, I'm talking about I go every single spare minute that I have, and that's February and March. but that's when I do most of my serious scouting is February and March. Of course, I'm looking for sheds. You know, I'm a big shed hunter too. I'm looking for a shed, a big shed. So that tells me he's there. But I'm also doing pretty much all of my, I scout during the summer too. But February, March is when I do my serious scouting.
I gotcha. Yeah, that's, I mean, everything, you can see the sign from last year, and you don't have leaves on the trees that are blocking. Right. Seeing some of that sign, yeah, totally. Totally.
But you can still identify, even during that time of year, you can still identify like different trees, and you know what trees are there. Even though the leaves are gone, you know what they are. Even the vegetation, like honeysuckle, I mean, it'll stay green here for a long time. May stay green the entire winter.
And really?
Yeah, I find a lot of sheds around honeysuckle. We have quite a bit of that around here. But, yeah, that's the time of year to get out there and find your spots.
Do the deer feed on honeysuckle? Like,
Oh, my.
See, I don't have honeysuckle around, so I'm not familiar with it.
Oh, my. Yeah. They love it.
That's good. And I thought, you know, I was like, my brain was clicking when you're saying it was staying green late. I was like, man, late season, that's probably a pretty good food source for them to key in on.
Absolutely. Do y'all have dogwoods up there?
We do. It's very sporadic, but we do have dogwoods.
So, like right now, deer are absolutely destroying dogwoods. Like, I'm talking dogwoods like, you know, 2 to 3 feet high.
Yeah.
New ones, not full-grown trees. But, like, the new ones coming up, they absolutely love dogwoods. Matter of fact, I've got two cameras right now that's just, it's like a, I call it a dogwood patch, but there's a lot of them. I've got two cameras right now that's dedicated on dogwood trees.
Really?
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
That is interesting. I guess like here, most of the stuff that we see as far as like that new growth browse, they like maples are a big one. Beech, not as much. We have so many beech trees. I don't know if you have those in Arkansas.
There's more beech trees in the Washita Mountains south of here.
Okay.
Not so much here, but in the Washitas, there's a lot of beech trees, but not here.
Yeah, because that stuff turns into a thick jungle, but the deer don't. I mean, they'll eat it. Deer will eat just about anything, but it's not. It's not like a preferred browse source as like either, you know, oak twigs or maple. I'm trying to think of some others off the top of my head, but it seems like I learned some of this from my forester buddy. He was talking about, he's like, everyone thinks that we were just leaving the cherry trees, which we, you know, and Pennsylvania is the black cherry capital of the world. And they're like, they think we were leaving them because they're a valuable tree. Well, he goes, they're not really that valuable anymore, but the deer don't like them as much. So they don't browse them as much. So they tend to, them and the beech tend to take over a little bit more than some of the other tree species, which is, I was like, man, that's really valuable information.
Yeah, it is. For sure.
It's funny when you pay attention to some of that stuff. And that's been like a goal of mine the last like 3 or 4 years, especially, is instead of just looking at browse and be like, oh, deer eating this, and really trying to figure out what it is that they're chewing on. So I can, you know, identify that in other areas.
Yep. But yeah, you need to, if you don't already, to the listeners, if you don't already know your tree species and stuff like that, that's valuable information that you need to learn and study, and I think that'll help you out a lot.
Yeah, and also another tip on that is I use, for the dummies like myself, I use this app called Picture This. It's a free app. I could take a picture of the tree, and it tells you what it is.
Yeah.
And so that helps, because apparently when I took all those classes in high school where I had to identify all the trees in Pennsylvania and get the leaves and put them in the book and do all that, I didn't remember as much as I would have hoped that I did. So.
Yeah. It's good to know those trees, yeah.
Oh, it definitely is. When I did a scouting camp for you, Rusty, the listeners have probably heard some of this, but I did a scouting camp back in April, and I've done it 2 years in a row now. And one of the best, the feedback I get is my buddy Kenny, who's a forester. I bring him as an instructor. And when we go walk in the woods, he's talking about all the different tree types and explaining it. And they're like, man, like that just opened up. You know, here's me with my, like in the focus around the pre-rut and rut primarily. It's like, I'm looking at sign, you know, deer sign that's laid down. And he's like, you just walked past this tree. I'm like, oh, I didn't know.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's super interesting. But I want to ask you about, if you have a story in mind of whether it was a specific deer that you were trying to target that you ended up shooting, kind of walking through that process, or just even a story of a memorable hunt that you can think of that we can kind of break down as far as the scouting goes, what it looked like and how you hunted them.
Yeah, I don't know if you can see it or not, but that, can you see this one?
Right there.
It's an 8 yep. point. It's 134 inch 8 point, and I believe it was 2006 when I killed him, but it started about 2003. And it's a Missouri deer, just across, it's still the Ozark Mountains, but just across the line into Missouri, Southwest Missouri. So I was up there doing some scouting, with my dad, and, it was in the summertime, and we were on public ground, and there was some private ground there beside us too, that we could hunt on. So we jumped that deer, and it was a completely new area. We just went up there and just went to a brand new area, and we jumped this buck, and I believe the first time we saw him was in August. So he was already pretty much fully framed out, and he just jumped up and he stood there, and my dad looked over him. He said, that's a mature deer right there. And this was in 2003. I said, yeah, you're right. So I said, let's just, you know, concentrate on this area right here and see if we can't find something, you know. And it was in August. I mean, you know how it is in August. I mean, everything is just so thick, and you know, there's not really any sign that you can for sure tell, you know, a whole lot about. So right where we jumped him, there was a big, thick huckleberry patch. And it made like I call it an interior edge, where it was just like a belt or just like a strip of huckleberries that went across this ridge. And the backside of this ridge, I mean, it was just super, super steep. And so we just walking around the rim of it there, and I noticed this little faint, just what we were talking about earlier. This is a good example of it. Just this faint little, I guess you could call it a crack, or maybe just a little ditch or whatever. I said, I bet he's coming right up that. My dad said, no, there is no way that sucker is coming up that steep ground to there. I said, yeah, you're probably right. So I just completely forgot about it, and we kept looking in the area. You know, we put some game cameras out, and we ended up getting a picture of him. I think we got two or three pictures of him in velvet. Never got a hard horn picture of him. He's kind of got out of my mind that hunting season. I never saw him. And so I ended up killing another buck, not as mature. I think he was a 4.5-year-old, killed another buck that year. So 2004, we did not get a velvet picture of him, but I was hunting, and I believe it was about mid-October, I saw him out of the stand. Same, you know, nice. He was real noticeable because his main beams, I don't know if you can see, but his main beams come out and they curl back in. Mm-hmm. So he had in really long eye guards. And so he's real noticeable, but he didn't come within shooting range. And that was in 2004. And I don't think I had another sighting or another picture. So me and my dad were talking. I said, man, I really want that buck. I said, I think he's old deer. I said, I really, really want him. And he said, well, you're going to have to think of something different. You got to do something different, you know? And so the next year, I really started getting serious about wanting to focus in on that particular buck. So I put more cameras out. We got more pictures of him. I got a really nice picture of him in velvet again that year. And I hunted him. This is in 2005 now. So this will be the third year hunting. And he was not changing. I mean, he stayed the same size. I mean, he's 100, mid-130s, 8-point. But I wanted him so fast. I become kind of obsessed. And I was killing bucks every year. But I kind of become obsessed with this buck because he was beating me. I just could not figure out how to kill him. And my dad, at the end of the season in 2005, he said, that's an unkillable buck. He said, that's what I call an unkillable buck. He said, he'll die of natural causes. I said, well, it ain't going to be because I'm not going to keep trying. So 2006 rolls around, and I jump him again in the summer. And that really, really got me excited. And I told my dad, I said, I think the season opened September 15th. I told him, I said, I'm fixing to hunt. I said, I know how to kill this deer. He said, no, you don't. He said, you can't kill him. He was challenging me. And my dad's a good hunter too. And he was hunting away from me. He was letting me have this one area, you know? And, so he challenged me. And, I was going hunting every single chance I could, trying to pinpoint where this buck was. I'd go in the evenings, you know, after work. I couldn't figure out why I wasn't getting very many. I mean, I'd get a picture every once in a while of this buck. Well, it's September 30th rolled around, and I tried to stay positive. You got to stay positive. You got to be persistent, you know, to kill some of these bucks. And September 30th rolled around. I got up that morning real early and hot. I mean, just scorching hot. This is 2006. And I even thought about not even going, you know, but
yeah.
I don't really care about the weather. I've killed them in hot weather, cold weather. I've killed them in all different types of weather situations. But I went ahead and forced myself to go that morning. And on my way there, I was already knew where I was going to go. And on my way there, I thought back to 2003, where that huckleberry patch was, where we jumped him years before. I said, I'm fixing to get right on the edge of that, where that huckleberry goes over that ridge and where that little crack was in that steep drop. I said, I'm going to put my back up against that steep drop. I'm going to try to catch him coming, walking the edge of that huckleberry. That's what I had in my mind. So I made my mind up driving to there that morning based on what I'd.
Well, I'm shooting a new bow this year and I am pumped. After playing around with a buddy's Hoyt RX8, the smile on my face made the decision for me. The first thing I noticed with the new Hoyts were their extremely smooth draw cycles and the ability to adjust the back wall to make it rock solid like I prefer. I outfitted my own RX8 with the inline accessories that made installation extremely easy and balanced out the bow. My favorite accessory so far is a simple one. It's the Go Sticks 2.0 adjustable legs to make your bow like a tripod, but it doesn't interfere with any part of the bow or the limbs or anything like that. In addition, the integrated kickstand within the HBX Exact cams protect your string from excess wear when you put your cam into the dirt. Ground hunting or spot and stalk just got easier. If you want to experience what I'm talking about, head to your nearest Hoyt dealer and take a test drive yourself. You can learn more at Hoyt.com. The Mobile Hunters Expo is a consumer-based hunting show unlike any other. It provides an interactive learning experience where you can try all things mobile hunting and learn from the best in the business. Come experience an unbiased, community-based environment where you can improve your hunting skills and find the right equipment for your needs. I'll be speaking at the Nor'easter Show in Mannheim, Pennsylvania at Spooky Nook Sports from August 9th to 11th, 2024. So come check it out or either of the other shows in Michigan and Georgia. You can purchase tickets online at themobilehuntersexpo.com or grab tickets at the door. I'll see you there.
Based on me jumping him in 2003. So I got in that tree that morning, nothing. I mean, it was dead. It was still. I mean, nothing was going on. Nothing was moving. Hot. I mean, I was sitting there just sweating. So I'm just sitting there, just kind of kicked back. I was on a little bitty tree about that big around, and it was just a straight drop behind me. I'm sitting there about, I'd say probably 9:30, 10 o'clock. I hear just, I mean, the awfulest racket you ever heard, just thrashing. And I turn around and look behind me. At the bottom of this steep draw, there's a sapling down there about that big around, and it was just whipping back and forth, just back and forth. And I mean, the old heart got to racing because I could see glimpses of the rack. I knew what was going on. I'm thinking, my God, he's right in the bottom of this steep. I said, there's no way he's going to come up through here. And when he got done with that tree, he started right up that steep. I'm like, are you kidding me? And I just, first thing I could think of, my dad was dead wrong about him coming up that steep ground. So he come up, I mean, he walked straight up. You would not believe how steep this ground was, but he walked straight up the edge of that crack. And I mean, it was steep. And he come right up and he popped out right beside where the huckleberries come across that ridge. And when he popped up on top, he was at 8 yards. And by this time I was already at full draw.
Yeah.
And I busted him at 8 yards.
That's
Yeah. Wait, I mean, he had no idea I was there.
Well, yeah,
it gets me excited just thinking about it.
Who's going to be stupid enough to sit here, right? He's like,
yeah, exactly. But I could not believe he came up that steep.
So how did you get into the tree that morning? Did you come up from the bottom of that steep draw, or did you come over the ridge?
No, I come over the ridge straight perpendicular to my tree. And I try to do, whenever I'm going, when I do my entries and stuff, I try to make a perpendicular, you know, a straight line to my tree. That way, if they're coming from either direction, by the time they got to my scent trail, if they did smell me, it's too late. He's already in my house, so he's dead before he gets there. But I came across the top of that ridge and went straight to that tree. The tree was right on the edge of that steep drop.
Yep.
But
okay, so you'd come up from the other side,
yeah,
and then dropped right onto that tree. You weren't walking the ridge top. You came up over.
No, okay. I come in perpendicular to the ridge. I had to go up a pretty, not real steep, but a pretty good angle, and then come in perpendicular to my tree.
Yeah.
So if he'd have walked in, if I hadn't had a shot as soon as he popped up, if he'd have walked around, by the time he got to my trail, he would have been dead anyway.
Yeah.
But that was a memorable hunt right there. I mean, that's one of my favorites. And my dad, I could not wait to tell my dad that he came exactly where he said he would not come. He's like, I can't believe that.
That's
to show you, you know, every deer is different. And I mean, they've all got different personalities. You never know what they're going to do.
Well, and it is kind of wild because, like, one thing I've learned from hunting southern West Virginia that's super steep and hunting down there, I watch, you can see in a lot of these old strip mines, you can sit there and glass like it's like you're out west. And I was watching some of these bucks and they'd use these rock ditches to go up and down and change elevation. And it's pretty steep and nasty. Like, I've tried to walk some of these drainages to go up, mm-hmm, and it's just like, I'm slipping and tripping all over as I'm going through it. And these deer, you know, were utilizing some of those places to go up and through. And that's super interesting that's how it worked. And the other thing, I'm glad you talked about the access there and how you did that, because I feel like for me and others, you know, access is always like a difficult thing. You know, I'll find these spots on these side hills and it's like, how do I get in there when you're not really sure where the deer are at night as far as to get up there? You know, a lot of times I like to either come from the bottom and go straight up to it, or like you said, go up and over, because you start walking the side hills, that's normally where the trails are a lot of times, and you're just dragging your scent the whole way down it.
Yeah, I try to make everything like at right angles and perpendicular to where I'm going. And you need to have really either a really good mapping system that you're following, or a tack trail or something where you're not meandering. you need to try to go in, or I think you do, try to go in perpendicular to where you're going to set. That way you've got one straight trail right in front of you. And I don't never come in from the back. I try to come into the front from the way that I'm going to be facing. See what I'm saying?
Yeah. Okay.
If he circles behind you, there's not a trail for him to smell, and you can circle around. But if he's in front of you and you come in at a right angle to your tree, I mean, by the time he gets there, you should already have your shot. I mean, you should have him dead before he gets to that trail, unless he's way out there. If he's coming in close, you know, you've got him. But if he could cross it way out there, you know, but.
I like your thought process there. And the way you explained it was, I feel like, really easy to follow as far as, like, how you're coming in at those angles. Because it makes a whole lot of sense as far as that goes. And also too, like, I feel like if they were to cross, like, even say a doe were to come through earlier that morning, they just get that little bit of the scent that you're crossing versus the entire thing is they're following it across there. It's like, okay, threat's there, threat's gone, you know, it crossed and went the other direction.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. I have that. It's funny because obviously I've never seen the spot, but you painted a good picture in my mind, and I have it pictured on where you're set up at and how the bushes were and that line. That's really cool.
Yeah, it's a pretty cool spot. And actually, I don't know if you can, it's way up over here, but the very next year in 2007, I killed another buck that was 142 out of the same tree. He did something totally different, but it was out of the exact same tree.
Really?
Yeah, back-to-back years.
Oh, yeah. Man, that's funny. What was I going to say? Those, when you find those trees like that, I love when you find a good tree that's just like, you know, you can go there multiple years and have success out of it.
Yeah. It's just a real good setup right where this spot is. It's a really good setup.
Yeah,
I need to go back up there and get in that tree.
Yeah, you're like, I need to go check that out.
Yeah, I'm thinking right now, I'm thinking, because I hadn't hunted, that tree's not there anymore. It's dead and already fell down, but I don't know why it died, but. Anyway, I haven't hunted that. I've got a camera. I put a camera up not too long ago up there because I didn't draw Kansas, so I'm going to try to focus in on Missouri a little bit more this year. But I did put a camera there, and I will be going back to that spot.
Oh, that's awesome. I'm be interested to hear how that goes. Like the buck I killed in 2022 is a place that I hadn't killed a buck from that tree. My dad had, but I'd killed one, or I'd shot at one there in 2012. Yeah, 2012, I'd missed the biggest deer of my life at, like, really close range, stupid range. You know, I was at that time I was in college and came back and hunted this spot, and I dealt with target panic and buck fever like you'd never seen. Like, everyone said I was the luckiest person in the world for having as many opportunities as I could, but I could never stick a deer at that point. Like, it was just like, it was terrible. But anyways, in 2022, I went back to that spot in that same tree and ended up shooting a deer in the same, he was standing in the exact same spot where I missed that one 10 years earlier. And it was just wild of how, you know, and it was over this big scrape in this, like, kind of the bottom of this hub, and it was just like, that scrape has been there for 15 years. It actually had moved to the next tree because that tree got struck by lightning and it died, and they moved to the next tree over. But it's just like one of those spots that just historically is good.
There are spots like that. I've got a few of them that I go back time and time again. It's just one of those spots, you know.
Yeah. The other question I had for you is the trail camera situation in 2003 and 2004. Were you using 35mm?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think in 2003, I've actually got that. I should have brought it in here with me, but I've actually got it framed. I printed a 10 by 8, like a normal frame, 10 by 8. I've actually got that trail camera printed out and framed of that buck in velvet.
Really?
Yeah.
That's awesome.
From 2003. I'm pretty sure we were still using 35mm back then.
Yeah, because I remember I got my first trail camera in 2004, and it was a 35mm, and that's what we were just talking about the other day at a family event. I think it was over the 4th with my with my dad, my uncles and stuff, they were talking about, I got this 35 millimeter camera and I was so excited. And I went and I put it out on I pounded a 2x4 into the ground and the spot and put it there and had it on this little opening. My dad's like, oh, he's never going to get anything there. But, you know, it was kind of like one of those things. That's where I wanted the camera. And that's what I was going to do. I was 11 years old or 12 years old, whatever. And on that roll of film, whatever it was, 12 or 16 photos that you could get, or I don't remember what it was. I had a 170 inch deer on that camera. I don't think I've ever told that on the podcast before. And wow. My dad was like, because at that time, you know, computers were starting to get good, like they're starting to get better. And he's like, did you Photoshop this? I'm like, no, we took it down to CVS and had it developed. Like, you were there with me. And still, that's a ridiculously big deer for Pennsylvania. Yeah. But at that time, it was like completely unheard of because antler restrictions were just put in place the year prior. So, I mean, if you shot a 90-inch deer at that time, you were shooting a nice buck, you know. And it was just like mind-blowing. And a guy ended up shooting it 7 miles away during gun season. It was just wild. But I remember the 35 millimeters, and I don't remember if we talked about this on the podcast either, but we were joking about like all the serious deer hunters would be sitting in the CVS parking lot they'd pay extra for the 1 hour photo developed and they just wait, you know, trying to wait for your photos to come out, and it'd be like doe, squirrel, doe.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. I remember those days. Oh. Man, that's something how far it's come.
Yeah, how nice it is now that, you know, they get sent to your phone sometimes and you know, if you have cell service and or just like SD cards, and you know, I'm putting 32 gig cards in there and video mode and it's crystal clear and you can see what it's there, and
it's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. It really is. I felt like in those times too, it was always, you'd always get the background buck, you quote it, because it'd be this buck in the background that always looks bigger because he's facing away, and it's this mysterious background buck that you can never get a photo of, and that's pretty funny. But how did you when you were getting pictures of him, how far away were the pictures from where you ended up killing that deer?
I'd say pretty much all of the pictures were within a quarter of a mile.
Okay.
Yeah, not too far.
And where you all jumped him at too?
Yep.
Okay.
Yep. Quarter of a mile. That was his core.
Was his core area.
Even though I didn't get very many pictures, I mean, and there's a lot of misconceptions about cameras, you know, and I've learned over the years, just because you're not getting pictures of him in that particular spot doesn't mean he's not there. I feel like that buck was there the entire time. And over that period of years, I mean, I probably didn't get, I don't know, maybe 30 pictures of him total. So, but I feel like he was there the entire time.
Yeah. Oh, it totally makes sense. My cousin Mason was hunting this buck that he ended up shooting last year, and he was hunting him hard. And everyone was asking him, like, how many pictures you get of him? He's like, only a couple. And like, what do you mean? Like, he's like, he said the same thing, because I really feel like these bucks are living under our noses more often than, you know, I know, even myself included, like I'd get pictures of a buck and then not see him again and think, oh, he was just passing through. Sometimes that might be the case, but I think a lot of times they're living there. Cause you look at it, your camera is only has a certain area that they're getting, and who knows, maybe he saw that camera coming up to it and got kind of weirded out by it and you know, doesn't pass in front of it. You don't know.
Yeah. I mean, the way I look at it, my game trail camera stuff, if I get one picture of a really nice buck, that's all it takes for me. I love getting a lot of pictures, don't get me wrong, but it's a location device for me. If I get that one picture, I know he's there, and that's all it takes for me.
Yeah. And I believe I had heard this when you were talking to Jacob and them, but the way you guys run your cameras are, you're doing more of like just spreading a web of them out and just trying to get pictures of, you know, getting a picture of a buck, like you said, using his location device, and then you go in and hunt the fine-tuned portion of it.
Yeah, I mean, all we're looking at, we're not even really putting cameras in a spot that we might hunt. I mean, where I would put a stand. We're putting them on like existing scrapes, making mock scrapes, like on top of ridges, My son, he's just got a new company and he's come up with a scrape juice. It's all synthetic that we put out and attracts them in. All we're trying to do is just get a picture, and they're mostly night pictures, not very many day pictures, but all I want to do is locate him. I just want to get one picture of him to know he's there, and then if it's a buck that I want to hunt, then that's when I start fine-tuning.
Okay.
And putting a plan together. Yeah.
Yeah. And do you move cameras like more to an area where you start to find a deer, or are you still just like not just keeping them in their locations?
Sometimes I do. Sometimes I will move cameras to where I think they might be traveling, but I think my son does more of that than I do. But to me, I just want confirmation he's there. I mean, yeah. I'll figure out on my own. You know, I don't really want to be real intrusive with, you know, checking cameras or, you know, putting cameras in where I think I might actually kill him, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. And do you feel like the cameras spook the deer at all? Like, do you have any concern with that?
I don't really have any concern with it. I mean, we run over 100 cameras at a time, and I mean, I see very little evidence of them spooking, especially nowadays that you've got the infrared ones. They don't have a flash or nothing like that. In my opinion, I don't think it spooks them.
Well, yeah, my buddy Johnny, the way his theory is like, he's like, these bucks that are growing up now, he's like, for the last 10 years, trail cameras have been pretty prevalent. He's like, they've grown up with them. It's just like part of their,
they're everywhere.
They're everywhere. So it's like, all right, there's another camera, you know, it's just kind of like part of the woods.
And it's kind of along the same lines on, you know, I hunt mostly public ground. There's a lot of pressure on the areas that I hunt, and people are worried about, you know, ground scent, you know, entrance and exits and stuff like that. And I'm not saying I don't pay attention to that stuff. I do. But as many people that are walking through these woods and hunting in there, I mean, you just got to find ways and pockets around that. I mean, they grow up smelling people all the time. So it's natural to them to smell a human being, because people are just walking all over the place. So you can also use that to your advantage too. Use people as an advantage on how to kill that buck.
Oh, definitely. And that I think the biggest like learning lesson for that for me was like I was hunting this buck and I was like trying to stay out of there until conditions were perfect and, you know, all these things. And then realizing I checked my cameras and I got bird dogs running through. You know, there's other hunters in there. It's like, yeah, maybe I'm not putting pressure on them, but there's people, and these deer have learned to live with the people and
they work live around with the pressure. There are certain things that you can do the deer, they'll get pressured and they'll get pushed into certain little pockets and stuff. And a lot of the stuff that I hunt, 99% of the hunters are not going to hunt where I hunt. I probably don't even, as far as deer sightings, I don't see as many deer as a lot of people do. But I'm really persistent and I hunt a lot and I hunt long hours and I hunt hard. And eventually, I'm going to catch that big buck slipping, and I'll catch him making a mistake. It might take 30 days, but I'll put the time in, and I'll eventually catch him slipping up.
Yeah, that's
rough stuff.
I was just going to ask you if when you're talking about where other people wouldn't go, if it was just like overlooked spots or if it's like just difficult to access.
It's both. It's both. One of my favorite spots is right on the road, and nobody hunts it. It's one of my favorite spots. I mean, it's not. It's less than 100 yards off of the main road, and people walk right past it. And those deer know they walk right past it.
Exactly. Yep.
But you know, I do hunt some hard to get to places too. That's little pockets that, I mean, just about nobody will do it, especially in early season when there's a lot of vegetation and briars and stuff like that. They just will not go through there. There ain't a buck big enough for them to go through there and put the work in to go in there after them. But I will.
Yeah. Well, it's hard. I mean, it's hard to do that, you know, day after day. And I'm sure, like, you know, I try to, but I have to like train myself with the mindset of every day when I go in, it's like, okay, this, if you do this right, this is the last time you have to do that. Whether that's going to be the case or not, probably not. But it's kind of like a mind trick, because it sucks going through that stuff. Like going through briars and you're getting tore up and you're doing that and getting into some of these spots. But I agree with you there.
Yeah. I want the listeners to know that, I mean, we just, like the story I just told was a success story, but there's also triple the amount of failures that go along with that. I don't want everybody to think, you know, you do exactly what I'm saying to do and you're going to kill a buck. That's not the way it is. I mean, you have a lot of failures. You have a lot of trial and error. You have to put the work in. You have to put the time in. And eventually you'll get your opportunity. But it's not... I think podcasts are great. There's a lot of good information out there. You get a lot of good tips and everything like that. But at the end of the day, you have to put the time in, you have to want it, and you have to be persistent and just be out there and hunt. That's at the end of the day, that's what it's all about. And you need to have fun doing it. It doesn't need to be a job. I absolutely have a blast trying to figure these bucks out. And you have to have fun doing it, and that keeps your mindset positive. You're having fun, but yet at the same time, you're trying to figure out these old bucks, how to kill them.
It's such a mixture of, you know, this hard grinding work that goes along with it, and then having fun and figuring it out and balancing, you know, all of that when it comes to it. And I'm glad you brought that up, because it is. I talked to hundreds of really successful deer hunters over the year through the podcast and through family and everything. And every single one of them, I think the one trait that they have in common is they spend the most time that they possibly can in the woods. And it's like they're going to the final bell rings, you know, they're not giving up or getting frustrated. You know, they might get frustrated, but get a reset and kind of just keep going, because it's, especially like in the places like you hunt and everything else, like, those deer are not easy to kill, no matter how great you think your skill set is. It's just not, that's not the case.
No, it is not the case. I mean, you can't expect to go out there just a day or two, you know, scout one day and then go hunt, you know, a weekend or whatever, and expect big results, because anybody can get lucky, and I've got lucky before, but to be consistent, you have to put the work in. You cannot be lazy. I guarantee you, all those hunters you're talking about, they're not lazy people. They put the work in and they're persistent.
Yeah, no, that's, you're exactly right. And it was funny when I was talking to one guy, and he was talking about like the successful deer hunters that he meets. And he's like, they all put in the time. And the other thing is, they all have like one thing that they hang their hat on, like one, you know, and you're talking about like those ditches and finding those. It seems like that's kind of like your thing, like that trumps other stuff, that if you find that's kind of where you're going to be setting up. And I think that's, and everyone's, and the, also the point of this is that there's not one way to skin the cat with it. Nope. You know, like that works for you. Someone could do something completely opposite, and if that works for them, then that works for them, and that's fine.
Absolutely. And that would be in my advice to like a new hunter coming up or somebody that's not having success, is go out there and roll the dice. Do, you know, take some advice from some successful people, but put all that together and find your own technique and find what works for you and what your own niche is. Don't just listen to one person. Don't just listen to me and go think you can go out and just hunt ditches like I'm saying. And you need to find your own way of doing it. And sometimes that takes a few years to figure that out. But just go out there and try different things. Don't be afraid to try different things. Don't be afraid to try calling or, you know, hunting, you know, in a thermal hub or a ditch or funnels or pinch points. Try everything. And you'll find what works for you eventually.
Yeah. I mean, and it's funny because, like, you know, what we were just talking about there, I've, and I'd say probably my number one like tactic as far as the actual hunting thing has been calling. And I've heard you talk about before that you don't really call at all. And I know my buddy, another buddy, Clint Casper, he's super successful and he's doesn't even carry a call. Like he's just totally against it. And I love calling and it's just like it what makes it what's fun to you, right?
So here I don't call that much, hardly none. But in Kansas is a whole different ball game. I call a lot in Kansas. They're way more responsive. The buck I killed this past season, I called to him, I snort wheezed him, I mean straight to my tree. Shot him at 11 yards or something like 11, 15 yards, something like that. But calling, like in the Midwest, especially in Kansas, has worked great for me. But in the mountains, it just doesn't – I've tried it, and it just does not work as well. I don't know what the reason behind that is, but it just doesn't. I try to ambush them here.
Yeah. Well, that makes sense. And to caveat that, like I've never had success rattling in the mountains here, but grunting and bleeding has been like something that's, but I've heard, I've never hunted there, but I've heard Kansas is like rattling is a really great tactic to be able to use.
It is. They're real responsive. I don't know if it's just the different species of deer that it is, or I really don't know the answer to that, but calling in Kansas really works. I mean, it really does. If you're not calling out there, you're missing out. It's a lot of fun.
Yeah, and too, like the reason why I've called, like I spent a lot of time calling in Pennsylvania and Ohio, and not as much in West Virginia, but one of the reasons is in Pennsylvania is like the deer density is low and there's a decent buck to doe ratio, where West Virginia, where I'm at, there's actually a lot of does, so they're not as aggressive. They don't leave the sign behind that they're leaving here, it seems like. So I feel like that, at least that's my theory on why that plays into it. But also it's just like, I can only see 30 yards in most places, sometimes less than that. And it's just like, maybe there's a deer traveling just out of range that I can't see. And I just try, doing some grunts or something to try to catch attention. But, and with that being said, you know, during the pre-rut and rut time frame, I call every 15 to 20 minutes and I don't get a deer coming in every 15 to 20 minutes. I can promise you that.
Yeah. You're right. You won't.
that's funny. But that Kansas story, so anybody wanted to watch that, that's the one that's up on your YouTube channel, United Outdoors, right?
Yeah, it's been up about 10, 11 days, something like that. But yeah, go watch that. Give it a watch. Boy, I had a blast. I didn't get the shot on film, but I was filming myself. And but man, let me tell you, I have my dad with me. He doesn't hunt much anymore because he had a back surgery and stuff, but he was with me on that hunt. He was staying at camp and he got to be on the recovery, and it was such an awesome hunt. Yeah. It's my son put the video together, and I was actually filming a Boone and Crockett like 30 minutes before I shot this one.
Yeah.
He was locked down on a doe. I couldn't get him to come in. And they might have been still – I was hunting a big CRP field. They might have still been in the field. I don't know. But when this one come across, I knew he was a big mature, and I called him right in. I couldn't let him go. But, yeah, it's on YouTube right now.
I loved watching that. You told me – when you told me it was up and we talked the other day, I went and I watched it, I think, that night. And I was like, man, this is great. And yeah, you didn't get the shot on film, but I think anybody that self films, I did the exact same thing last year, where all I had, or not the exact same thing, all I had was the deer's antlers and frame because I didn't have it angled right. And I just, it's frustrating, but the story behind it and the whole thing came together really well. And I think anybody would appreciate to watch that and check it out.
Yeah, it was quite the hunt. I was extremely excited about that deer. I can't wait to get him back from the taxidermist. He's going to look pretty good.
You talked a little bit about like the ditches and stuff as far as the correlation, but is there anything else that correlate between, you know, hunting the mountains and hunting like some of that ground like you have in Kansas or anywhere else? Cause like there's a lot of listeners that, I mean, the podcast name is East Meets West, and a lot of it's, you know, planning these trips, going to different places.
Right.
And just curious as far as like what you found to be similarities between the two.
Yeah. So I'm real big. I like these little ditches and stuff, but I'm real big on like gaps. And I guess my best way to describe it is like a opening in a fence. But it doesn't have to be. It can be an opening through vegetation, and it works really well out in Kansas. And I don't know if you remember in the video there, but there was a ditch that ran out to the middle of that CRP field, and right at the end of that ditch, there was a gap, and then there was a little patch of Bodart, Osage orange trees, and I was in one of those in that little patch, but there was a gap right there, and that right there was what I was hunting mainly, the ditch also, but mainly that gap. I liked it. And like if you I love hunting CRP fields out there, and if you find something like that in a big CRP field, like a ditch that runs out into it that's really thick, they'll travel that edge. But if you can find a gap in that, and if there's a tree that you can get in, or you might even hunt him off the ground. But those little gaps like that, oh my gosh, they're dynamite, man. They
Yeah.
use them. They use them.
Oh yeah, that makes sense. And again, if anybody that's wants kind of visualization, you can see it in the video there. Because at first it was crazy once you guys panned out on the camera away and you pointed to the tree that you were hunting in there, and it really gave you a good visualization because you could see your point of view and then from what it looked like from afar.
Right. Yeah. I don't know how big that CRP field was. It's pretty good size, but I mean, there's also bottoms, down the side of it and stuff. But sometimes those bucks, and I killed that buck in November. It was, gosh, I don't even remember what the date was now, November the 9th or something like that. But sometimes those bucks out there will never get out of that CRP field. They won't even get down in those drainages. They'll stay out in those CRP fields. They'll bed out there. I mean, they'll stay out there. They'll run does out there. And if you can find like an isolated tree or just any kind of structure whatsoever, those things are just like magnets to that deer. I mean, he may be out in that CRP field, but at one point or another, he's going to come by that tree or he's going to go through that gap. I mean, it's just like I look at it as magnets. It's hard to describe, but it's almost like I can use this, like if you're fishing deep water structure, a bass will be attracted to that structure. That's the same. It works the same way with these deer. If you're in a big CRP field and there's a patch of trees out there, they're going to come by that patch of trees at some point. I mean, it's just like a magnet. I think it's maybe the cover aspect of it that they just like it to be close to them. But I mean, right before I shot that buck, I don't think it's on the video, but I videoed it with my phone. There was a doe come right underneath my stand, and she was eating those Osage orange dried leaves off the ground. I mean, she was eating them one right after another. I'm like, she's eating those leaves off of a Bodart tree? But I mean, she was just eating them one right after another, those dried leaves, and you can hear her just crunching them. She was directly below me. But
That's
yeah,
funny.
she walked right through that gap.
Well, and I guess you could probably compare those CRP fields to, again, for anybody that's familiar with clear cuts or logging cuts, like a 3-year-old cut where you get like those blackberry briars, like at least here, you get blackberry briars and thick, growth coming up. It's not, here, say it'd be 4 or 5 foot tall, maybe even a little lower, but it might be this giant clear cut. And sometimes those bucks, they'll never really leave there because they got everything right there. But you find those little island of trees that they might leave, that they seem to be attracted to and going
Absolutely.
through. So that could be somewhat of a comparison.
Another thing, people like hunting Kansas, like in the CRP fields, I call them plum thickets. I'm not even sure if it's a plum or not, but I call them plum thickets. There's a guy that I know out there. That's what he calls them, so that's what I call. But they're like, it might not be, but 20 or 30 yards wide, but just like little patches of these plum thickets, and they'll bed in those things. I could not tell you how many deer have jumped out of those little plum thickets in that CRP. They love bedding in those plum thickets.
I wonder, is it kind of like a bush that like has an overhang to it?
Not really. It's like a tree, and it's kind of reddish tint color to it. I wished I had a picture I could show you, but They're like in patches. And the guy that I know out, he lives out there, and he calls them plum thickets. I'm not even sure exactly if that's what they are or not, but you see them in CRP fields a lot out there.
Interesting. I guess I can't exactly visualize. I guess I was thinking about it as almost like how mountain laurel or rhododendron or autumn olive bushes are in the east, where you get like these bushes where they get a little bit of that shade cover too, because I always jump deer bedded underneath those or find sheds underneath them underneath those types of bushes. But that makes sense. No, that's cool, Rusty. I appreciate you taking the time and talking with me on the podcast here. I love hearing those stories and just kind of breaking them down. And I love that you pulled the retro story there from Missouri and kind of explaining that situation, because I feel like that's something that, you know, again, I could visualize it. So I'm assuming that the listeners could visualize where that's at that type of area and be able to explain it. So thank you for breaking that down for us.
Yeah, no problem at all. No problem at all. Don't let the weather deter you. It was hot that day. I don't know what the temperature was, but it was super, super hot.
But yeah. Well, last thing I was going to ask is, do you get very cold weather where you're at there? Like, do you get snow ever or anything like that?
Yeah. In a normal year, we'll get two or three snows. Sometimes more than others, but you can just about count on about three different snow events that we have here. And it does get fairly cold. I mean, like in November, you'll get, you know, 20s, 30s.
Oh, okay.
For lows, and highs in the 40s, stuff like that.
Okay, so you do, okay.
It's
you
not
do,
bitter cold, but I mean, like in December and January, we could get like down in the teens and stuff like that, but you know, that's late season stuff.
I was going to say, man, I don't envy you guys in the southern part of the states as far as early season. Like, I hate it when it gets, you know, up above 70 degrees. I know you're probably dealing with that pretty regularly. Yeah. It's just a mess.
Yeah. It gets warm, but again, you know, to the listeners out there, don't let that deter you. There's been a lot of big bucks killed in warm weather. Just go when you can go and spend the time in the woods. Don't get real, try not to get too technical, you know, hunt within reason, but you know, don't get too technical and think that you can't hunt in hot weather, because you can. You can kill them in hot weather as well as cooler weather.
I like it. Yeah, I like it, because that's one thing I do get questions on too, is like, you know, I don't get the time that like, or I can't take vacation like you can, and you know, pick the days. And it's like you said, hunt when you can.
Yeah, and hunt when you can. I mean, if you've got a day off, go hunt, man. I mean, every chance you can get in the woods, it's going to be to your advantage, and it's going to up your odds. So just hunt when you can.
Yeah. Well, Rusty, where can people find some of the other stuff that you guys do? I'd recommend them following along, but you want to give some shout outs?
Yeah,
there?
So we have our social media platform is United Outdoors, and we also have two other companies. My son started a company called BranchBossGear.com, and he has kind of invented a little synthetic spray that you can spray on scrapes and stuff like that. And we use that. He developed it over about 4 or 5 years. I helped him trial and error till he got the right formula together. But we use that to put in front of our cameras to get pictures of these bucks. And he's also got bow hangers and scent wicks and stuff like that on their t-shirts. And we also have another company called Fireside. It's firesidestore.net. And we sell t-shirts. This is one of them right here. It's got, this is the biggest buck I ever killed, a 186 from Kansas. It's on there, but he's not behind me. He's over here on another wall, but that's my biggest one. But, so we sell t-shirts and caps and stuff like that on that website as well.
Nice. I like that. I noticed the shirt there earlier, and, that's sweet that you're able to pull, you know, the Euro of the, like your buck and put it on there. I like it.
My son drew that. So
really?
All of our designs and everything, my son does every bit of that. He does all of our designs. So We're not farming that out. That's all original stuff that my son does.
That's awesome. Well, cool. I definitely urge everyone to check it out, and I'll put some links in the show notes here. But, oh, Rusty, thank you for taking the time and coming on here and talking.
Yeah, it was awesome, man. Love it.
Yeah, appreciate it.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of East Meets West Hunt with your host, Bo Martonic. For more great content and to stay up to date, visit eastmeetswesthunt.com, Facebook at East Meets West Outdoors, and Instagram at East Meets West Hunt. If you enjoyed today's episode, please review and subscribe, and we'll catch you next time.